Dr. Dana Saperstein and the Fear Me Out podcast is pleased to announce that Janus Community Counseling Services is now the proud sponsor of the Fear Me Out podcast. Janus Community Counseling Services is a nonprofit organization in Santa Barbara, California, that is committed to providing professional, affordable counseling. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to the podcast. For more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.
There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, I have the great pleasure of continuing my series on how to thrive as a highly sensitive person. And today, I'm interviewing a very lovely woman by the name of Amy Zimmerman. And Amy has graciously agreed to come on the podcast, even though she was a little bit shy about it. But I think her story is incredibly insightful and inspiring. So Amy, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you for having me and inviting me here. It's true, while I am a highly sensitive person, I love to do a conversation about this and about human nature and my own journey with it, with being a highly sensitive person. And then also I am can get very nervous about my own performance. So we'll just work our way through it. I did think of something funny. I think the first time you told me, do you know you're a highly sensitive person? My first feeling about that was it felt like an insult. Like it felt,
really?
Yes, it oh. felt like it was, you were saying something bad about me, even though I knew you weren't.
Oh, okay.
But it felt to me like, I knew you weren't insulting me. But it felt to me like I failed in some way.
By being sensitive.
By being a sensitive person. That it meant that I was a problem and that it meant that I wasn't doing my job good enough.
Wow, I'm so sorry.
Well, no, I don't mean that. I don't mean that to say that you did something wrong. I'm just sharing sort of that first hit of reaction of being called a highly sensitive person. Uh-huh. And how I'm sure for other people that it feels like that's something wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
And going back a little bit into my childhood is I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles, like a middle class home. I'm in a family of six, my mom and dad and my three older sisters. We're four girls sort of all in a row, all within 5 years. And my parents had a very traditional setup. My mom was, you know, at home with us, and my dad was a lawyer and was building his own law firm at a certain point. And he was very driven. He worked all the time, and we rarely saw him.
So he was a very busy guy.
Very busy guy, very focused on his work, very focused on building his firm and his reputation.
Okay. So what was it like growing up in that family from an emotional perspective?
Yeah, it was. I like when you've said before, you told me about how your mom, the temperature gauge, and she would make it higher and lower. Do you know what I'm talking about?
It was either anxious or panic.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are the only two settings available on the thermostat.
Yeah. Okay, so that was my dad.
Oh, okay.
So my mom, when we would be at home during the day, you know, she was busy with four little children. Yeah. And so there was a lot of, you know, playing with sisters, or at that point, in the beginning of my years, 1 through 5 or 0 through 5, at the first house we lived in, you know, it was just playing in the house. And then when he was going to be coming home, my mom would put us all away or tell us to go into your rooms. And so there was this heightened feeling of when he would be coming home, that we had to be not seen and not heard and out of the way.
And did she say that explicitly, or did she just say, go to your room?
She would say, he's on his way.
Oh, okay.
He's on his way. Everybody up to their rooms.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds horrible.
I actually know. And I don't know if she meant it as frighteningly as I heard it.
Yeah.
It may have been just like, don't be an inconvenience to your father right now. He's had a hard day. Okay. But it was very much like that was correlated, like quickly everybody up to your rooms. He's on his way.
And when were you allowed to come out of your rooms?
That was usually it for the night, because he would get home. Yeah, he would get home around 8 or 9 o'clock at night.
Oh, so you didn't even have dinner together?
Yeah, no, we never had dinner with him until at some point we did started a Sunday dinner, but that was infrequently. He was working really, really hard to build this law firm, and
so you really hardly saw him.
Hardly saw him
during the week.
Hardly saw him, and then maybe on a Sunday he would stay home, but he was he had intense energy. So when he would come home, he really was high strung. He did not want to be bothered. You know, he'd have his few beers. You know, I don't think he was like a scotch drinker, but you know, this is the 1960s. And I think every time we drove, it seemed like he had a beer in his hand while we'd be driving without seatbelts back in those days.
Right. Right.
So that was a lot of the vibe I was feeling, this sort of like intensity around my father and around needing to be quiet. A lot of that children are seen and not heard,
right,
type of thing. But it's even don't be seen, don't be an inconvenience. So those were some of the messages I was getting.
And were you taught to be afraid of him or just to leave him alone?
Leave him alone. And he could have an temper. Oh, so that would be scary.
And how did that show up?
Well, I don't know as far as like, I learned to just not approach him very often, but my feeling that I get when I reflect on it is whack-a-mole. I don't know if you know a game, but it's like in my head, it's like the mole sticks its head up out of the little thing and then you whack it down. And that's how it felt being with my dad, is that if you sort of stuck your head out, and showed yourself, that he would whack you back down. So, wow. You know, this is how it felt as a child. So I don't really know how that was showing itself in those early years.
And do you feel like being a really sensitive person heightened the experience?
I'm sure it must have. I'm sure it must have. I mean, I definitely responded quickly when she said, get upstairs. Or I remember looking out my door down towards the kitchen and seeing him, and I would just then avoid. So I clearly was feeling fearful,
right,
and hesitant.
And did you share a room with any of your sisters?
Or? Yeah, my sister Jennifer. Yeah, we shared a room together, and then the other two shared a room.
And how did she react to your dad's arrival?
I feel like everybody did the same thing. Oh, I mean, okay. I definitely, my memories are very sort of absorbed just from my own perspective.
Right.
And so, and then my mom definitely towed the line with him. Like, I feel like also he could be tough on her at that time. And so she could do a good silent treatment when she was upset with him, but she definitely, you know, did not provoke him. She knew not to provoke him. It wasn't physical. It just was like, it was just a, you know, anger or like a verbal degradation, you know.
Toward your mom?
Yes.
Did you feel defensive of your mom?
No. I think, you know, to go back, at that time, my mom with those four kids, I think she relied a lot on neighbors to sort of help take care of us.
Oh, okay.
Like four little girls, you know, like five and under at that point when I'm born. And actually one funny story is when she was going into labor with me, my dad took the other three to his sister's house to drop them off and then come back and get her to take her to the hospital. Well, he got lost trying to get to his sister's and was gone for a couple hours. Oh my God. She had to go next door to the neighbor's house, who she knew really well. And it was a bunch of ladies in their 50s, and they were having a poker party. And so these four ladies in their poker party, who had been drinking and smoking all night, just said, "Get in the car. We're driving you to the hospital."
Oh my God.
And they drove her to the hospital, and I was born. Luckily, my dad ended up making it at some point, but to the hospital. But so there was a lot of, I think she relied a lot on neighbors.
Yeah.
And that's where part of my early childhood trauma comes up, is there was one neighbor that we would go to and swim in their pool.
Okay.
And at some point, one of the relatives of that neighbor became sort of obsessed with me, is a word that was used by when just my mom used that word. And unfortunately, sexually abused me several times.
How old were you when that happened?
I was four.
And your mom noticed that he was obsessed with you in some way. How is it that she wasn't able to protect you from him?
I honestly don't know. I'm still to this day not sure what she actually knows about my experience.
So you've never spoken to her?
No. Okay. I've asked her around about it in a round way, asking about that person. And that was actually a few months ago. She said, you know, he was really obsessed with you. And he would come down and get you and say he'd take you up, you know, can I take her for a while? And my mom just must have thought it was all innocent. I don't know. But I still am coming to terms with this in some ways. I'm still on this journey of acceptance about it, or healing about it. And so with my mom being 86, I'm not sure yet how I'm going to communicate with her about it, or if I will.
Okay. And so when it happened, did you keep it a secret?
I kept it a secret. At some point, I told my dad.
And so you did tell him what happened?
Yes. At some point, I tell him, and he reacted very badly. He reacted scary, rageful, and...
toward you?
Yes, almost like I was the problem. And it just brought on a lot of shame. And because I was 4 years old, I can only go with the memory of it is the feelings that I sort of hold in my body.
Right.
And as I let myself feel those things, I can sort of get, you know, memories of it. But again, I'm 4 years old. So memory is, you know, I can't remember exact conversations or how I said it.
And how in the world does a father of daughters protect a perpetrator that sexually abuse one of his children?
I don't know. I mean, the messages that we got as girls in our family is that girls were subservient to men, or okay, women were subservient to men.
Okay.
And that there were very few roles outside of our house in community that he wished for us. You know, it was really like his view was that women's roles were to make the household a better place and to be a good partner to a man. It was very, very sort of traditional old patriarchal thinking.
But he had no sort of outrage that something sexual happened to his four-year-old daughter?
You know, that I can't speak to because I don't know. He could have had outrage and he could have expressed that, but not around me. You know, maybe he expressed it. I don't know how he handled it. But what happened, my experience with him and our interaction, was it really shut me down.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it really shut me down. And it the message was, like, you are not safe. You are an inconvenience. Like, basically what it felt like is he chose to protect this man's embarrassment by throwing me under the bus, in a way, is what that felt like.
And so how did this abuse stop?
I'm not sure. We moved when I was 5.
Oh, okay.
So I know it stopped then.
Okay.
But at that 4-year-old mark, I remember I just started spending all this time in my room alone.
And did your mom continue to send you with him when he came to get you?
I don't know.
So you can't remember?
I can't remember. I don't remember a timing of like...
So she didn't really know what happened? Your dad didn't tell her?
I don't know.
She didn't act like she knew.
I can't imagine she would still send me with him. I really can't.
Right.
They may just have been like, no, you know, I don't know.
So you remember shutting down pretty intensely at that point, and I'm assuming that you blamed yourself in some way?
Yeah, there was two things that happened. The abuse, which was really confusing. You know, I don't think I even understood as a 4-year-old, like what all of this was.
Right.
I mean, I definitely have gotten in touch with rage from that 4-year-old.
Right.
So I know there was a lot of suppressed feelings. So be almost, you know, just the idea of being held down with no choice. So that surrender,
right. Uh-huh.
And surrendering to feeling powerless. And then the reaction of my dad to what happened with my dad was like a whole secondary experience, right, that really changed the way I conducted my life and saw myself and needed to protect myself and stay in my room and just self-soothe. Like I would do this bongoing, which was sort of rocking back and forth. And I would just, my mind, it was like clearing my mind, and I would just bounce, like sit on the ground against the bed and just kind of, my parents called it bongoing. And I just would sort of bang rhythmically against the
To try to calm your nervous system.
To calm. It was just my 4-year-old way of doing that. And I continued doing that till I was an adult.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so how did you end up sort of coping in school and all of that after that happened?
You know, I think that when I had to walk out my bedroom door, I knew that I had to perform and put on a mask, so to speak. And it took a lot of energy to walk out that bedroom door and go out into the world. But, you know, I was raised Catholic and in this family, and you just be a good person and you be kind to people. And I just had a very, very high tolerance of to be able to hold in this inner turmoil.
Yeah.
And not display it outwardly or not. I never turned to drugs or alcohol. It's just, it was a real strong reaction to, I have to lock this all down.
Right.
Yeah.
And as far as you know, this did not happen to your sisters.
No.
And why do you think that you got singled out? Do you have any idea now looking back?
I don't know. You probably have an idea about it, do you?
Oh, well, I do, because one of the things that I've learned in doing a lot of research about being a highly sensitive person is that sociopaths and perpetrators deliberately go after the most sensitive person that they can find. And the reason that the perpetrators do that is because they know how kind a highly sensitive person is and how unlikely that person is to fight against being used or abused or taken advantage of, because that would make you feel like a bad person, especially as a little kid.
Yeah.
That you're supposed to be compliant and you're actually supposed to be in charge of managing the pain in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that instinctually perpetrators can feel who is much more likely to go along and not fight and not, you know, do anything to interfere with them having their way.
Yeah.
So I don't know about your sisters, but I'm assuming, I don't know, are any of them as sensitive as you are?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, for sure. My oldest sister, Jill, is. You know, I just think maybe because I was the youngest.
Yeah.
I mean, I think all of what you're talking about is is accurate. And then as well as being the youngest and also being 4 years old, which is easier to manipulate than my sister, who maybe was 9.
Right.
So, yeah.
So you described to me a situation recently where some of this came forward as an adult. Are you comfortable talking about that just for a brief moment? And then
sure.
We'll get back to the sensitivity part.
Sure. I became a pretty good secret keeper because of my experiences. I would just hold that. And also I a really good being able to suppress a lot of this emotion around this and memories of it. And I'm not saying that as a badge of honor, but it's a coping skill that 4-year-old developed that is pretty awesome, you know, that helped her get through the world. And as I became an adult and made room and space and had curiosity for what was being held in my body and causing a lot of anxiety and depression, I opened it up and got more brave at looking at it. So I had confided in one of my sisters about the experience I had gone through with the abuse, and was very supported by her. And she was a great sounding board to help me be a little bit more of a memory of our neighborhood and things like that. And recently, we were all at my mom's house, and we brought out some jewelry of my father, who has since passed. He passed 8 years ago. And my sister pulled out this St. Christopher charm that hung on his keys. And as she was showing it to us, remember Dad had the St. Christopher charm, and she held it right near his pocket where it would have, the keys would have been in his suit pocket and it would have hung out. And she said, remember, it would be right here. And as she showed that, I immediately felt like, first of all, I have to get out of this room. So I quickly left. And I felt just rage towards my father for not protecting me. And my oldest sister came running out, and she thought I was upset because my dad's passed on. And so I said, no, it's anger. I'm furious. And she just held me, and I just let that 4-year-old come out. I mean, it was coming out. I don't know if I could have stopped it. But just the feeling of he didn't protect me. He did not protect me. And just the sadness and the rage and the fear and the anger around it. And it just sort of all came pouring out. At that time, my two other sisters didn't know anything about this. So they came outside, and my husband, who does know and was wonderful at helping me out. But my two sisters were looking just with such concern on their face. And so I said, I have to tell you something horrible that happened when I was little. And I told them, and just looking at their faces with the concern and hearing them support me, not question me, actually it made a lot of sense to them. And feeling also one of my sister's outrage about it and the other one's sensitivity to it, it was this amazing healing opportunity for this 4-year-old.
That is really incredible. And you've been working really hard on resolving this for a while now.
We have.
And it's amazing that just sort of happened out of the blue.
I know.
In such a healing way, even though I'm assuming it was quite uncomfortable.
Yes.
I think that the reason I wanted you to talk a bit about it is because I think that when you pursue healing, the world sometimes cooperates with that intention. Mm. It can catch you by surprise, but it sounds like even though it was a painful surprise, it was incredibly healing.
Yes.
Do you feel like it's still kind of reverberating in your family with your sisters?
I think it is.
Yeah.
We had a lot of communication by text for the next couple of days, but then I kind of pulled back to sort of let things calm down in my system. But I'm really excited. I'm going to see them this weekend. I'm really excited to reconnect and just check in with everybody because, I mean, that's hard for them to hear.
Yeah.
And it also stirs up a lot about our childhood, whether, you know, whatever the different experiences are. We all know that feeling of feeling oppressed in our own family system.
And none of them had any idea that this was happening when you were a little kid.
You know, it's interesting. My oldest sister, who was like I said, 5 years older than me, but like a second mother, she was my savior at the time because she would come and get me out of my room.
Oh, okay.
And say, do you want to go downstairs? And she would turn on music.
Oh.
And I would just dance.
Oh.
And she said, you would just lose yourself. And I think that that release was so important. And it's funny because music became a connector with her all through our lives. Music's so important to me. And she introduced me to rock and roll. She introduced me to Bruce Springsteen, Journey, all these great bands. And we still kind of share music trivia back and forth and things like that. And so she says, I remember when you started to close yourself in your room. And, but she's like, now she's like, I wish I knew more, which is just too much to expect.
Well, the cool thing is that she noticed the change.
Yes.
The sad thing is that she was too young to really understand.
Yes.
What might have taken place.
Yeah.
But at least she was trying to help as best she could.
She was. And she had, everybody had their own role that they were struggling with in the household, you know, that they were, and she was the oldest. And so she had to take on a lot of responsibility.
Right.
And, you know, that's not always, there's great things that came from that and then hard things that come from that, as with anybody's role in the household.
Right. So going through junior high and high school, what was that like for you?
You know, I still pretty much, when I was at home, kept to myself. When I was at school, I got into sports. I had good friends. I felt really good at school. And then when I would come home, I basically would just go to my room and lock the door. And the same thing, I would sit on the floor against the bed and just sort of bounce back and forth, but I would listen to music.
Oh, okay.
And so that's when I would turn on, you know, the old record albums, uh-huh. The vinyl.
Right.
You know, I had my favorite things to listen to, and I just would rock for hours.
Really?
And just zone out. Yeah. And that was my way of just getting through a few hours of the day.
And your mom never sort of wondered what happened to her daughter?
She never asked. She never asked, no.
Wow. Do you think she ever had any idea, or was she just too preoccupied with being a mom and trying to manage everything on her own?
She's not one to want to talk feelings.
Oh, okay.
So that would not be something she would want to approach. Talking feelings and even physical contact was just really not something comfortable for her. So we learned that growing up that, she wasn't, neither of my parents were people where you would climb on them or sit on their lap or anything like that.
So as a really sensitive person, your need for affection is also heightened. How did you just basically shut yourself down and make it all go away?
I must have. I had a blanket.
Oh, okay.
So, my blanket named Banny. So that helped, you know, that was a comfort item that I had when I was little. I had my sisters. I'm really close with my sisters. You know, I think we played a lot of house. We played a lot of games. I think we really found a lot of comfort with each other.
Yeah.
My older sisters were able to talk more about dysfunction in the household, like when they got to the preteen years. And then I wasn't really part of those conversations. Those conversations would make me feel very anxious. So even
if they spoke,
if I started to hear that, I had to sort of get out of there because it felt like that's dangerous to do that.
Like what kinds of stuff would they talk about? That was
even just things like dad's being so mean or mom did this, or, you know, really those great healthy conversations that siblings have.
Yeah.
But because of my history and because of sort of that just emotional landscape like that became very dangerous in my mind. Yeah.
So, the combination of sensitivity and I guess PTSD, for lack of a better word, putting it, had to have affected your romantic relationships moving forward. When you look back now, do you see that that was the case?
For sure. For sure. I definitely became somebody who was sensitive to other people's energy.
Yes.
You know, I had done that with my father, to make life okay. You know, you sort of had to manage his anxiety and discomfort and his shame. My dad had a lot of shame. He had had an injury when he was younger, when he was 12, where he lost his foot and became like bullied after that. Mm. And told himself, I am going to be more successful than all these jocks who are making fun of me. And that became part of his drive.
Oh, okay.
He and I became closer, you know, and resolved some things, not around this topic that I've brought up, but just around other things. And we were able, I was able to ask some questions. And so I start to understood more. And he started to be able to understand more of his shame. But I got kind of comfortable with, I knew how to do that, manage shame, manage other people's feelings, protect people from their feelings, all at the expense of myself. But at that time, it was almost a badge of honor that I could do that. It was being of service. It was some value that I had that I could offer someone.
Did you feel burdened by their pain?
Not at first.
No.
No. When I've been married for, let's see, we'll be on 34 years.
Okay.
With my hubby. And when I first met him, we kind of spoke the same language. He had had some childhood trauma. I yet didn't know the extent of my trauma at that point. And he had had a pretty traumatic incident when he was young, a very violent trauma that he and his parents experienced and never talked about again. And so it's sort of like we had that in common, even though I didn't quite understand my trauma, but right. I knew about keeping secrets.
Yeah.
And I've talked to my husband. He's open for me to share and discuss.
Okay.
On this podcast. So I don't know if that resonated with me on some level, that there was just a deep connection between us. And when I saw this person who had such pain, childhood pain, it felt like a fit. Like I know how to be with that and support that. And he became my project.
I know that you laugh, but it's such the common way that really sensitive people approach relationships is by being the pain manager.
Yes.
And the idea that if you can save the wounded puppy, they'll love you forever.
Yeah.
And I mean, we can thank Walt Disney for turning that into a multi-billion-dollar business.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly during our childhoods, everything we ever saw was all about rescue. Although it's kind of interesting because back when you and I were younger, even though I'm much older than you are, it was always men rescuing women. Now it's completely shifted to women rescuing damaged men.
Right.
But the recipe is still the same.
Yeah, which is not a good recipe.
No, because it doesn't really work in the end. Because first of all, you can't possibly absorb enough pain to help the other person. Plus the other person ends up feeling controlled by your attempts to manage their pain. And so it really just does not work at all. So are you comfortable talking a little bit about how all of this affected your marriage?
Yes. Okay. Let's see. So being a highly sensitive person, which I didn't even realize at the time, it gave me this capacity to read what was going on with my husband when he didn't want to read what was going on with him.
No, it was you're the reader.
I'm the pain in the butt. Uh-huh. And, you know, I definitely had a sense of hypervigilance where I could scan the room and pick up from, you know, his body language or his face or the vibe in the room of what would be going on. And there just became a time where he started to really protect himself. His parents went through a divorce when we were together, and my husband just sort of shut off from wanting to feel all that. I think it was just all so painful, and so here I am feeling it and not knowing what to do with it. He was not aware of a lot of it. And I'm coming in with my sort of knowledge base of where I was at and trying to understand, what is all this pain and distress that I'm feeling? Is it mine? Is it his? And I definitely, you've talked about the rescue fantasy, and I definitely had that I, if I loved him enough, if I supported him enough, and of course, this is from my perspective. I'm sure he has a very different perspective. But that idea that he could take on his sort of pain that has sort of bled into the family, and that he could take it on and work through it and then be present for me to work through my pain. And that was the setup I sort of went for many, 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 many years.
And how did that work?
Not well. Yeah, honestly.
Can you describe just a bit about what you experienced? So, that, I mean, again, what you're talking about is so, so important, because this is such a common theme that happens in the face of trauma and being a highly sensitive person.
Yeah. So it was, at different times, very painful, because I would spend my day overthinking, how can I resolve this discomfort in our household? How can I help bring that temperature gauge down? Because I couldn't live at that temperature. It was too uncomfortable for me. But I had learned to maybe tolerate really uncomfortable things. And for my husband, the temperature that was uncomfortable for me was better than what he had felt as a child. So for him, this was like, I'm okay here. When he really wasn't, he was still suffering. Yeah. And so he was, you know, at work, working hard and, you know, building a financial security for our family. And he'd come to the kids' games and attend things at school. He was really engaged on those things. Yet I was the one that seemed to be responsible for the emotional well-being of the family in ways that I couldn't possibly correct or control some of these things.
How do you think that affected you emotionally?
I think it was really hard. In my mind, if I could just do better,
so
if
really,
I could just
again,
do
was,
better.
In your mind, it was your failure, not
yes.
his unwillingness or inability to just kind of face what he needed to.
There was a period of time, like a big block of time, like 15 years, where I did feel like it was his.
Okay.
And I was much clearer I was always sort of in therapy working on my own things, and I was much clearer on what his process was, his own process with his own energy, and how he was not really ready to look at it. And at some point, it felt like, at that point, I was really connected to my HSP traits.
Right.
I was meditating. I had meditation groups and connecting with other people who are highly sensitive, which is like lovely when you get in those mm-hmm. conversations.
Yeah.
I'm horrible at small talk, but, you know, could love to talk about a deep topic. So I had that whole world where that expression and intuition was really full for me yeah. and a great experience. And then I conversely had my world with my husband, which was emotionally really shut down, and me really unclear and working from my unhealthy habits, not knowing how to do better. It was really hard.
So I think what you've told me in the past is that you ended up kind of abandoning yourself in order to preserve the marriage.
I did.
And that was a conscious choice that you made.
That was a conscious choice. It felt like I was going to lose my marriage if I didn't sort of slow down and sort of put the intuitive side of me, put it on hold a little bit,
and
try to build something up with him.
It's so sad, but at the same time, it sounds like you sort of recognize that you couldn't get what you wanted, so you had to either accept it
yeah.
and go on or lose it.
It's true.
And it was too much to bear.
It was. And we had a therapist, so I felt like, okay, let me trust this process.
Okay.
At some point, I did feel like I'm losing too many pieces of myself here. And I also started to internalize that this is my fault. And so this return to, this is my responsibility. There's something wrong with me. And it wasn't that like you're too sensitive. It was that nothing's good enough. It's that I kept looking for this peace that I wanted, this level of connection, this level of authenticity.
Yeah.
That was like not comfortable for my husband at all.
So you let it go for a while.
Yes.
So what brought you back to kind of reclaiming yourself?
I think working in therapy with my awesome therapist, and learning how to be an advocate for myself. First of all, being an advocate for that four-year-old, that's yes, the part I love.
Absolutely.
That I learned is that's where it could start. It's hard to like sometimes be an advocate for myself at my current moment here, but to be an advocate for that four-year-old and be like, we're going to get better right now. We're going to do better. We deserve good things. And I'm just, that's very simply put, but that's just that sentiment taught me to start to love myself more and have a lot of self-compassion.
And was there a process that you went through that helped you connect on a deep level with what you needed to come to terms with?
Yes. The process was understanding that I'm good the way I am, that I'm okay the way I am, accepting pieces of myself on the way to accepting myself as a whole. I'm on that journey and understanding what's my responsibility, what's not my responsibility. All of that was just really important to bring me out of the fog of confusion and get me more clear about aligning with my own goals and who I am. And in that way, I felt safer to take the risks to say, this is it. We need to figure this out now, or I need to continue on. And that didn't mean separating per se, but it meant I'm going to focus on myself.
Okay.
And that was a huge shift.
And do you feel like it had an impact in a positive way on your marriage?
It did.
Are you comfortable describing a bit about what
sure.
that's been like?
Yeah, I think it really, when I stopped holding my husband's energy and sort of that feeling of like, I'll hold this until you're ready to take it. When I put it down, it was like he had to pick it up. And he's been super brave. I'm just, yes. Yeah, he's amazing. He's going into things that are really hard that he clearly has avoided for a long time because it's so scary.
Yeah.
And he understands the value of doing that. It's really been an exceptional change. And
it must be a huge relief for you.
It really is. Yeah.
So do you feel like you've been able to embrace your sensitivity as a result of reclaiming sort of yourself?
I feel like I'm getting there. Like I said, I had this experience of these years during my meditation and my groups where I felt so good about it. And so I'm excited to, not in that same way, but in other ways, embrace my intuition and my creativity. And I'm working to do that now. And to share my experience with other people like I'm doing here and understand like we all go through different things and you think everybody's life is good and then you get in a conversation and you realize how much you have in common with other people of things that are hard.
So it sounds like it's much easier for you to be present to yourself.
Yes, for sure.
And what about the shame having to do with being a sensitive person that you felt as a child, but... Do you still carry that or do you feel like you've been able to let that part go?
I feel like I'm letting it go. I think it's funny. The other day I said to you, you were talking about, the positive aspects of being a highly sensitive person.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I always felt like a pain in the ass. And you said, well, I'm not saying you're not a pain in the ass.
But that's a good thing.
But that's a good thing. And well, then I'll take the pain in the ass and I'll also take the person who's intuitive and kind and enjoys being aware and in celebration with people's journeys, yeah. you know, and the human experience. And I mean, I just love all of that.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
Now you're preaching to the choir.
I know.
So I know that you have aspirations of doing work as a psychotherapist, right?
Yes.
What's that journey been like for you?
So that journey opened up a lot. I got my master's in clinical psychology a couple of years ago, and I've been working on my hours to get licensed as a MFT. And, through that journey of taking classes and being brave at my age, I'm 57, to have a new chapter and go back to school, that was all just great, tremendous growth for me. And taking the classes in these subject matters, you know, definitely opened me up to self-discovery, more self-discovery. So that's been at times hard, but also very rewarding and very necessary for me. And now learning to work with other people and create a space where people feel safe and I can help them along with their journey. So I look forward to it. I'm just starting my hours and I've got a ways to go before I'll be licensed, but I really, look forward to working with people.
So you can use your sensitivity as a, in a positive, healthy way.
Yes. I find that using my intuitive nature is easier than sometimes recalling exactly what happened in this class. Okay, here's the approach I'm supposed to take.
Right.
I just feel more comfortable working with people. Yes, I have that knowledge base and can pull from it when I need to, but also this intuitive part, this holding space together, that part is really important to me.
Do you think that your husband recognizes the asset of sensitivity in you?
I think he does now. I think at different times, he has shared, he has said, thank God for mom. She's gotten us through so much. So there's this appreciation. The sensitivity part, I think he's understanding. I think it felt like a threat for a long time. I understand why. He did not want to go there.
No.
And then you have a wife who's just there all the time.
Yeah.
So that's hard.
And what about your kids?
Our kids are, it's interesting right now, the curiosity and their own exploration of what it has felt like to grow up in a household, again, with tension, right, in our household. And I'm along for that ride. I want to have those conversations with them. And
do they know how sensitive you are?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Yeah.
You smile. Do they tease you about it?
They can tease me. Yeah, they can tease me. I mean, believe me, when they were teenagers, they hated it. And they were like, why can you not just ground me? Why do we have to have this conversation?
And, I'm sorry to laugh.
Oh, my God.
That's hysterical.
Yeah, I was probably pretty relentless in that way, and they had to suffer through that, and I'm sorry, you guys.
Maybe it's not something to be sorry for. Maybe letting them off the hook by just grounding them or whatever would make it easy for them not to really acknowledge their own behavior.
Maybe, but teenagers, that's the last thing they want to do is talk to mom about their feelings.
But you insisted.
Yes, I was probably, like I said, pretty relentless. But now, they understand who I am. And it's, I asked for feedback actually last time when they were here. I asked them for feedback on how is it when I'm doing this? And I got some feedback from my son that's helpful. And
what did he say?
Well, he said, sometimes you just go really meta. So we'll be having a conversation. It's like I zoom out and look at it and relate it to human nature, And
was that a compliment or a...
I think it was just an observation.
Oh, okay.
And my daughter's sensitive too. So okay. She and I have lots of really good conversations. And
because most of the information that I've read recently about what causes high sensitivity is that it's actually a genetic biological phenomenon. It's a brain, it's a difference in brain wiring, because they're doing imaging now of people that have been identified as highly sensitive. And it turns out that different parts of their brain get activated based on stimuli that would activate it, an average person in a different way. So it's actually a function of the parts of your brain that get activated, which is you have no control over from a behavioral, you know, perspective. It's really driven by your biology.
Yeah.
And it's very distinctly different than like 85 to 90% of the rest of the world whose different parts of their brain light up under the same circumstances. So it's, you know, I don't know what more proof you would need to know that this is not something that you have any control over, because it's genetic. It's inborn to the person that you are.
Yeah.
I do understand that it's a cause for concern sometimes for other people that would be in a relationship with you, because as I've talked about many times before, when you're a really sensitive person and you read the room, there are some people who would prefer to remain anonymous, right? Because they have secrets that they're ashamed of. And so inherently, on an unconscious level, you're a threat to those people. And so they're going to do what they can to either shame you into submission or avoid you, because you represent what they don't want to have anything to do with. And the choice of not wanting to have anything to do with it is obviously a choice, not always conscious. Because I know lots of really lovely people that would prefer not to go anywhere near how they feel, especially in relationship to the things they feel ashamed of. So it makes you sort of a lightning rod in certain ways, that people are either going to be drawn toward you because they can sense that you get them and that you're going to provide them with comfort and understanding, or they're going to want to run away from you because you represent sort of revealing their secrets. And so it takes kind of, it takes neutrality out of personal relationships of any depth. And I think people feel it, at least certainly, you know, I joke all the time that I can empty out a room like nobody's business, because all I got to do is tell people what I do for a living. And a lot of times people can't get away from me fast enough, and they're neutral until they know what I do for a living.
Aren't you more comfortable with people though who want to be drawn to you?
Oh, sure. I mean, at this point in my life, I make fun of myself. Everybody makes fun of me because I'm weird. I take that as a compliment that they've noticed how weird I am, you know, and that, yeah, I think it takes an enormous amount of courage to look in the mirror. And I understand that most people don't want to do that. It's too scary. I mean, that as a therapist, I see the pain that I help people sort of recognize inside themselves. And sometimes it's so monumental that the person can barely even stand up after a session that we've had, because they feel so, maybe for the first time since the pain was created, just like, oh my God, I can't believe I felt this way my whole life, but I've just kept it buried or pushed it away, or my symptoms always took precedence over me being able to go here because it's been too scary and painful. And when they feel courageous enough to go there, it's a miracle in my mind, and I take huge compliment that they feel comfortable enough with me to let themselves go there. But man, it is not easy to go into that kind of pain, because I think it's actually even more than most people could ever imagine they could stand. Because some people say to me, if I let myself go there, I'll never be able to come back. And my response is, well, I'm just going to remind you that that pain is not current. It's pain that you've carried your whole life. And it feels that overwhelming because it's based on you being a little kid and you couldn't cope with it as a kid. But now you're an adult and you have resources available to you now that you didn't have when you're a kid. And that actually really helps people recognize that this is not about what's happening in their life right now, generally speaking. It's left over from years ago and that they can handle it.
Yeah, I relate to a lot of that. When I first thought I was... when I was first in therapy and needed to start to feel these emotions that were bubbling up inside me. And it, was I going to let it, you know, cascade over and out and everything, you know, I'm holding it in just terrified. That feeling was like jumping off a cliff. I didn't know if I'd survive. If I felt this. Like it was so intense when I first started doing that, and then learned how to slowly get a little bit better with it. And then just through the years.
Well, and some of it has to do with how much stimulation that you enjoy as a person, generally speaking. I mean, I know as a sensitive person, most really highly sensitive people don't like that feeling of overstimulation.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just feels like an assault. And then there's weird people like me who are super sensitive, but really like certain aspects of going fast. And I mean, right before we started our podcast, I was sitting outside after lunch and these two people flew by on their paragliders. And I'm watching these people thinking, oh God, I wish I had the body that I could do that. And if I crashed, I wouldn't die,
right.
You know, because they just looked like they were having so much fun flying around. But, you know, it's super dangerous. It's a really stupid thing to do. Man, did it look fun.
Yeah.
It just brought such a smile to my face to see them floating around over my house.
Right.
But there's no way in the world I could do it, but mm-hmm. I'm drawn to it.
You're drawn to that. Yeah.
Cause I like that sort of excitement of speed.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on how you're wired.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
But I will say that most people that are highly sensitive are not wired to seek a ton of stimulation because they already feel overstimulated to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure where you fall in that category.
I feel like for me, there's ways that I feel more free and expressive.
Uh-huh.
So that could be in something with a lot of stimulation, like a concert or
yeah.
something like that. A lot, you know, a Zumba class. I love a good Zumba class. Uh-huh. You know, just that, you know, freeing movement.
Right.
With the music, but at the same time, I am sensitive to loud noises.
Right.
So, I can get really easily dizzy or really start to shut down if I'm around a lot of loud noises. But strangely, when I'm at a concert of somebody who I love and I'm dancing, no problem.
And that's a loud noise.
Yeah. It's almost more if it's like an assault, you know, like from behind me when I'm not expecting it. You know?
Sure. Yeah. So what am I forgetting to ask you about in the world of sensitivity?
Well, I guess I'd love to just add in some of the things that have been really helpful for me that we didn't cover.
Okay.
And one is, as a highly sensitive person, is finding your tribe, finding your people who speak that language.
And what does that mean to you specifically?
Well, for me, when I was feeling so lost, like I found this acupuncturist who uh-huh. we have in common.
Yes.
A good friend. And he spoke this language and it was like such a refuge. And it also brought confidence and, okay, right. People do like to communicate this way and be, and tend to each other this way in this sort of very kind way. So, that was really helpful. And like now I'm a part of two different groups where it's people who are open and honest and as authentic as they can be to look at their lives. And that's really meaningful to me.
Therapy groups or just?
Two therapy groups. Yeah.
Okay.
And one's a therapy group and one's a group for therapists, which I'm a part of. And it's just my people, you know, I love listening to their stories. They're there to support mine. And to me, that just really fuels me.
Yeah.
So finding people that speak this language, I think has been really important to me. And movement and music, which I mentioned, that has also been a way for my body to release a lot of the held energy.
Yeah.
And I just enjoy... Yeah, dancing or, you know, I mean, in your kitchen, you know.
Uh-huh.
And being able to move and release energy that way.
Okay. And anything else besides those three things?
I think to just, for me, to never give up hope and to, for me, I'm just always a work in progress. I don't ever feel like I hit a finish line.
Okay.
And that's okay with me. And, to just be compassionate to myself, be gentle and kind. It allows me to be gentle and kind to other people.
Do you think that it takes a lot of courage to open yourself up to your nature in this way, that it's taken a fair bit of courage?
Yes.
Where'd you find the courage? Do you know?
I want to say desperation.
Well, that's, you're laughing, but that's a very strong motivation for sometimes for people.
Yeah.
That they feel so desperate that they got to do something.
Right.
Because they just can't live the way they're living anymore.
I think it's desperation to be able to be myself.
Okay.
So how do I be myself? I need to figure out what this whole highly sensitive thing is. And I didn't even know the term.
Okay.
But what is the sensitivity that I have?
And what about a spiritual life? Do you think that that matters to someone who's highly sensitive?
Yeah, it matters to me.
Are you comfortable talking a little bit about that before we finish?
Sure. For me, it's kind of hard because I had such a vibrant spiritual life for a while, and then I kind of closed that part down. I'm just coming back to it.
Okay.
Part of it is connecting with my intuition, but also trusting that there's a higher source or a nature that brings things around organically.
Okay.
Sometimes you have to fight to find it. Like I've had to fight through things to find it, but then I've also been in the flow where I feel it. And it also makes me feel I'm not alone, which is really important.
Well, and especially in the face of things that are really scary or painful, to feel like you're not alone is magic.
Yes.
Because I think fear takes people down because they feel so helpless and alone in that fear. And so if you can figure out a way to kind of, like you say, I was walking with my this morning, I called my daughter to say hi because I love to, check in with her in the morning. And I said to her, I'm not sure where I'm going to go with the podcast after I'm done with the highly sensitive, series that I'm doing. And she started laughing and she said, Dad, you're going to find a sign on the sidewalk written in chalk about where to go next. And, she's joking with me because I have these experiences that happen all the time in the most unexpected ways that kind of lead me in directions. And she's come to expect that that's just a part of the way Dad lives in the world, that the world's going to be weird, but he's going to find good meaning out of that weirdness.
I love that.
And I think it's true that if you're open to it and look for it and feel and allow yourself to feel hungry for it, that it's more likely to become a really important part of your life.
Yeah. It's a superpower.
Uh-huh.
It feels like a superpower.
Yeah.
It's just something that, that I wish was more understood in our society.
Yeah.
And especially for people starting off in relationships and I wish it was more understood. So I'm glad you're doing this podcast.
Thank you. And I have to tell you, you have been incredibly candid and really delightful person to interview because it just seems so easy for you to just talk about the real things in life. So I really appreciate you being here and giving me the opportunity to include you in my series of How to Thrive as a Highly Sensitive Person.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.